There is this thing.
Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is February 18th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I'll be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyengahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM, Tuesdays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a special Black History Month edition of the Montreal Sessions. The month kicks off on February 1st with the best in reggae and soca with your hosts, Production Sounds and Soca Head. Week 2, February 8th, Wizzy Moonchaser, host of The Morning Detour, broadcast live from DG Kicks, a sneaker store in NDG. The final 2 weeks, 15th and 22nd, are hosted by Stephen Ziplocks Hennessy, educator, creator,
and part of the L Groove Garden team. Don't miss it.
In all public indoor spaces. By February 21st, the passport won't be required in places of worship. The change will coincide with the arrival of Quebec's first COVID-specific antiviral treatments. A report by the Quebec's coroner's office has found that the 2017 fatal shooting of Pierre Coriolan by Montreal police while he was experiencing a mental health crisis can be attributed to a lack of sufficient police training to de-escalate and communicate and, quote, obsolete, unquote, training of police on rapid intervention tactics. And Team Canada wins gold in women's hockey with a 3-2 victory over the United States at the Beijing Olympics, setting an Olympic record with 57 goals throughout the games. The win was 4 years in the making as the team lost to the U.S. and settled for silver in 2018. 18 months after the federal government announced the production of the Novavax COVID-19 vaccine, Health Canada has approved the vaccine for use on Canadians 18 or older. However, reports suggest that the vaccine is no more effective than 90%. Health Canada will provide data regarding protection against the current and emergent variants of concern soon. On Wednesday, one student was charged with second-degree murder for the fatal stabbing of 16-year-old Lucas Godet, a student of John Rennie High School, on February 8th. The stabbing occurred during an altercation between two groups of teens outside St. Thomas High School in the West Island. Two other teens are due to appear in youth court at a later date. Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we're sharing the air with Pam Palmater's Warrior Life podcast. We'll tune into an episode about Indigenous identity, fraud, and the harms it causes First Nations with Indigenous experts Dr. Winoa Wheeler of the Fisher River Cree Nation, Dr. Kim Tallbear of the Siston Wapton Oyate, and Dr. Veldon Coburn of the Algonquins of Pickwagonagon First Nation, and Pam Palmater of the Eel River Bar First Nation. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Welcome back, Warriors. Kwe Tansei Sego Anibuju. Kwe Nindeluizi Pam Palmater, and I'm the host of this show, The Warrior Life. This podcast is a show about living the warrior life, a lifestyle that focuses on decolonizing our minds, bodies, and spirits, while at the same time revitalizing our cultures, traditions, laws, and governing practices. And it's also about asserting, living, and defending our sovereignty all over Turtle Island. And one of the ways in which we have been able to maintain our identities as Mi'kmaq, Wolastoqe, Kanyengahaga, or Wet'suwet'en is through our living relationships and connections to our immediate families, extended families, clans, houses, villages, districts, communities, and our nations. our nations, with our rich diversity of languages, cultures, and identities, have lived on Turtle Island since time immemorial. And the focus has always been on our relationships with one another and with all of the other living things within our ecosystems. Centuries of violent colonization and genocidal laws, policies, and practices by settler governments have attempted to erase our indigenous identities and cultures as a means of denying our sovereignty and our inherent rights to govern ourselves and our territories. The resulting genocide has taken a huge toll on our nations and continues to be one of the biggest barriers we face today. The Indian Act in Canada and historic legislation in the United States tried to define our diverse nations as one Indian race that could be measurable by some arbitrary notion of blood quantum to measure our degree of Indianness and thus entitlement or disentitlement to things like food rations. There have been many things done to our nations in the name of forced assimilation and attacks on our identities. Indian residential schools and day schools or boarding schools in the U.S., forced sterilizations of Native women and girls, forced adoptions, also known as the 60s scoop here in Canada, the foster care crisis of racist birth alerts and child apprehensions, the Indian Act, which has served to disentitle thousands of First Nations women and children from both Indian status and membership in their First Nations, and even today, despite all of the changes to the Indian Act forced through court cases, there are still many thousands who have yet to be registered. One of the most negative impacts of colonization is that settler governments have effectively set blood quantum as some kind of determinant of our identities and how we get to belong to our communities, not real blood measurements, because as we all know, you don't get 50% of your blood from your mom and 50% of your blood from your father. It's a notional form, a fictional form, basically a legal fiction created to serve a purpose, to ensure the legislative extinction of Indians or First Nations over time. And this reliance on blood as identity not only serves to disentitle people at the community level, but it creates an opportunity, a door, an opening for non-Indigenous peoples to point to a distant ancestor 500 years in the past as the basis for trying to appropriate Indigenous identity in the here and now. This works perfectly for the government because it erases Native people on both ends. While identity theft, fraud, or appropriation is nothing new, there is a trend happening right now where members of First Nations, the Métis Nation, and Inuit are calling out pretendians. From Grey Owl and Joseph Boyden to Michelle Latimer and now Carrie Bourassa, powerful people in powerful positions who have used Native identities for their own purposes are being called out. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. Especially in universities, governments, and the arts. The pretendians are literally everywhere. Today's panel is a powerhouse of Indigenous experts who will help us understand this issue, the deep harm that it causes, and what universities and other institutions should be doing about it. Today, we are so lucky to have with us Dr.
Winona Wheeler.
We also have, who is an associate professor in Indigenous Studies at the University of Saskatchewan. We also have Dr. Kim Tallbear, who is a professor in the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta and holds probably the coolest Canada Research Chair name I've ever heard, Indigenous Peoples, Technoscience, and the Environment. And of course, Dr. Veldon Coburn, he's an assistant professor at the Institute of Indigenous Research and Studies at the University of Ottawa. Thank you all so much for joining me today, especially on a weekend.
Quay, thanks for having us.
Okay, so as is our custom on this podcast, I invite each one of you to introduce yourselves and where you're from in the way that you like to. And perhaps, Winona, we will start with you.
Thanks. Winona Wheeler,
I'm from Fisher River Cree First Nation, but my family comes from George Gordon First Nation in Treaty 4 territory. And I'm speaking to you today in the traditional lands of the Willow Cree in Treaty 6 territory.
Welcome. And how about you, Dr. Kim?
I am in Treaty 6 territory in Edmonton. I am Sistan Wapton Oyate, which is a Dakota people on the eastern side of South Dakota. I grew up there in part Flandreau-Santee Sioux Reservation and Sistan Wapton, also partly in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I've been at the U of A in Edmonton for 6.5 years now.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming back to the Warrior Life podcast. And of course, Valden. Valden, you've been on the Warrior Life podcast before. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, Kim and Winona and Pam, sorry. Yeah, welcome to all of you. Thanks for having me all. I am Algonquin. I'm from the Algonquins of Pequawknagon. I'm actually seated right now in my own territory, high up in the hills of what is known as the Gatineau Hills, north of Ottawa. And I'm glad to be amongst all of you.
Oh, that's awesome. I couldn't think of a better panel to tackle some of these issues. And we're not going to go through all of the basics. We're going to hit the hardcore issues right off. But just for some of the listeners who might be tuning in for the first time, or they might not be familiar with traditional Native customs, it's actually common practice for us in our nations for us to ask each other where we're from, what's our community, sometimes even who are your parents? Who are your grandparents? Who are you related to? In fact, sometimes when we introduce ourselves, that's where we start. You know, my grandfather was this person, or my grandmother was this person, and so on and so forth. And we always include reference to our home community, our nation, or our relatives, sometimes our clans and houses. Basically, we situate ourselves. And for me, that's always been one of the red flags when I ask someone just naturally, because it's such a habit. When I come across someone who says that they're Indigenous, it's like, oh, where are you from? And they instantaneously get offended, or they respond with some kind of vague reference to heritage or ancestry, and they can't really locate where they're from. Kim, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about this custom and why we do it and why it's so important.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's often you'll hear people kind of express the stereotypical notion, our ancestors are our strength, right? Which is true. Our ancestors can be a source of strength, but they're also our baggage. So, you know, how we are perceived in Indigenous community and across, you know, pan-Indigenous spaces is often, to some degree, about who our relatives are. I mean, it's not because we come from communities that emphasize communalism, right? And then emphasize relatedness. So it's not who you are, quote unquote, is not really mostly or only about you as an individual. Who you are depends on, or how you are perceived in those communities. Who are your grandparents? Who are your parents? You know, I've gone around, I'm from the United States, and I've got a family that have been very active in politics and different kinds of Native organizations over decades across the country, both in tribal and national kinds of venues. And people will, I'll have to say who my family is. And sometimes that's an asset. Oh, this is my mom, or this was my uncle. Sometimes it's not an asset, right? And that's kind of what happens. This is the deal when you come from Indigenous community. And I think people who, not even just people that are fraudulently making claims, but people who do have legitimate claims to be related to us, but who didn't grow up around that, sometimes I think have a much more individualistic worldview. And their idea is about who I am as an individual. And because they haven't been raised in a place where who they are as an individual is very much entangled with who their family is and who their relatives are. So I think, you know, also because we're all related, and we say tribal communities in the US, you have to know how you're related to people. Are you cousins? Well, then you better not date. You know, there's pragmatic reasons as well, because we are all related. We need to know how that works.
Yeah, very pragmatic indeed, especially when you come from a First Nation like mine and there's like 300 people on the res. You better know who you're related to. You know, just a follow-up question, Kim, because you've been on this Warrior Life podcast before, and I've heard you, you know, read your writings and heard you speak in the media, and of course, Media Indigena, about this issue of identity versus relationship in the context of people claiming indigeneity, you know, on ancestors from like hundreds of years ago, for example, versus living relationships with community. And can you expand on this? Why you consider it's like the relationship is really more important than this concept of identity?
I've been saying a lot lately, I think that identity is a poor substitute for relations. So again, because it's, and I'm getting this like allergy to this word, you know, and so I'm always putting it in scare quotes now. I think settler state culture thinks we're talking about identity, or maybe it's just a distraction. So again, it's an individualized concept, and it's often related to our biology, which is something I study, right? I wrote a book called Native American DNA. So people can think identity is about a biological link to a certain nation, but it can also be a social and cultural link. But at any rate, it becomes very much individualized. And when I did a search recently on Shutterstock for an article I'm writing for visuals, and 90% of the visuals around identity were about standing out as an individual. They were about who am I as an individual. This is not what we're talking about when we're talking about defending Indigenous rights as collective rights. And those rights and relationships are about us as peoples and our responsibilities to land and place, right? So that's why I think identity does us a huge disservice. We're really talking about maintaining relations. Our relations to land have been disrupted. Our relations to our children and our ancestors have been disrupted. And the theft of children in incarceration in residential schools, the theft of bones, blood, and DNA, the theft of our biological data, in addition to land and resources. So really what we're talking about, the whole settler colonial project is about disrupting our relations about with our relatives. This is not about who am I as an individual. And I think we should, I would plead with people to stop using that word, or think when they use that word, whenever they can, are you talking about identity or are you talking about a set of relations? And this is where I think people that are disconnected from community, from Indigenous communities, whether they have a right to be connected or they don't, miss the mark. You know, they are not understanding these claims to sustaining and rehabilitating relations. They're thinking it's about me as an individual. And the degree to which we can move the conversation away from that, I think, is helpful.
Oh, that it's so important, especially how you're talking about this disruption and theft of land and theft of culture and theft of children. And so, Winona, on this theme of theft and identity theft, you know, I've seen it in the media called appropriation, or kind of like accidental, unintentional usurping of Indigenous identity. And I've also seen it described as outright fraud and opportunism. And you just wrote an important article called Indigenous Identity Fraud in the Academy, about this so-called phenomena of race shifting or pretendism, arguing that this should in fact be considered fraud and academic misconduct in a university context. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Yeah, thanks, Pam. The little piece that I wrote, it was only about 3 pages long, and I wrote it for our University of Saskatchewan Union Faculty Association newsletter, because the reality is university people have no idea. They're clueless and they don't understand what all the kerfuffle was about in the national media. The vast majority, I'd say, there's always a handful that are clued in a bit. So I wrote this article to explain to them what it was and to explain the impact it has on students. So I figured that was the fastest way to get information out there. It comes from, everything that Kim is saying is so important. And back in, do you remember back in 2015 when the Andrea Smith issue, identity fraud issue arose, we had the Native American Indigenous Studies Association. We did a statement on Indigenous identity fraud, and we stipulated way back then, you know, it's not that we're excluding everybody else who's non-Indigenous from participating in our life and research, but it's the integrity, it's the honesty, it's the relationships that we really highlight and that we want to promote and that you need to be honest about. And so based on that, I did this article. The reality is that when it broke out, when the Carrie Bourassa issue broke out at University of Saskatchewan, our students were absolutely devastated. You know, they were just devastated. I mean, we expect Indigenous scholars to come into the classroom with a whole bundle of Indigenous experiential knowledge to be able to speak from the heart, to speak from experience, to speak from our relatives and our ancestors' experience. And so all these years, students have been listening to her and then discovered that she appropriated and stole all of those experiences, that they weren't hers. She fabricated them. So on an emotional level, you have students that were devastated. And then you've got this whole whack of graduate students who are dependent on her, for example, for their livelihood right now, especially those she's supervising or those who are working as research assistants, she's sitting on committees, she's supervising, she's paying for research assistant positions and giving grants to. So our students were absolutely demoralized. And I really think it's important for people to know that it's not just an identity thing, right? That it has a huge impact on a lot of different people.
Well, exactly. And I've heard, you know, in the social media world of pretendians fighting back, saying that what we're doing as Indigenous scholars or people calling for accountability is we're creating an unsafe, harmful place for Indigenous students who are now fearful to identify as Indigenous, and versus what we actually hear from Indigenous students saying, this is horrendous to actually have been misled this whole time, to have learned from someone who they don't even know if the quality of the academic content that they were getting is true. Have they been misled? Have they been miseducated? And they worry about how that impacts them when they go to apply, say, to grad school and say, oh, but I was associated with that person, so maybe I didn't learn what I needed to know. And so I feel like every time we raise an issue around harm to students or things like that, you know, those with the fraudulent identities are saying, we are the ones causing the harm and hurting students and other faculty. I mean, How do you respond to that, Winona?
Well, that's just their self-defense mechanisms, right? I mean, honesty and truth is more valuable than lies, right? I mean, students want to know the truth. They don't want to live under a pack of lies. And I feel so sorry for students who have the names of pretend Indians on their dissertations or their theses, and they're looking for work, right? It's going to be really hard. People are going to question. Other people are going to question. So when they do that, it's just a self-defense mechanism. And it's amazing that some who get caught will fight tooth and nail with everything they have at their disposal to hang on to, quote unquote, their identity, right? And then to blame other people. And I've been charged with lateral violence. I've been accused of lateral violence. I've been accused of internalized colonial violence. I've been accused of all sorts of wacko things, when basically what I'm trying to do is stand up for the students, stand up for the younger faculty who don't have a voice in university, and to call this crap out.
Exactly. And I think it's important that, you know, people understand it's not just a few famous people. And Valden, this is what I want to talk to you about, because recently we all know what happened at Queen's University. We're not even picking on any particular university. This is like happening at universities all across the country. Will likely happen at mine pretty soon. But at Queen's University, a large group of Indigenous academics, including all of us, signed an open letter to Queen's calling them out for doubling down and defending a number of staff who had been called out as not being Indigenous, not having Indigenous ancestry, Indigenous community connections, and not siding with the Indigenous staff, faculty, and students who would be impacted, so negatively impacted by what this happened. And I'm wondering, like, you made a really, like, in this letter, there was an important argument around how when they did that, they were essentially attacking our nationhood, sovereignty, and autonomy to decide who is a citizen of ours and who isn't. And I'm wondering, for people who maybe not be familiar with that letter, if you can explain what we were talking about there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, to go back just a little bit, because of Winona's remarks on the academy, you know, shortly after Carrie Bourassa came out, Dr. Chris Anderson, who's the Dean of Native Studies at the University of Alberta, Kim's faculty, is he had an opinion piece too, and it really highlights the point that universities are spectacularly poor at their approach to understanding or shoring up pretendians at the expense of Indigenous peoples. Like they, it can be harmful, just as you say. And in Queens in specific, because it touches on my nation, there was a lot of pretendians that were pointed out in that particular report who were claiming to be Algonquin. And how this becomes an issue of our nationhood and sovereignty and autonomy is that it infringes upon our internal ability to determine who we are, who constitutes the body politic. So, you know, for the longest time, we've been reduced to races, oftentimes cultural flavors. What do we do? What do we wear? What do we eat? What have you? But not anyone who had developed sophisticated political communities, the ones where we had citizenship and we could determine our modes of internal governance and how we relate to other nations, what have you. So in the whole scheme of sort of European Western thinking, race was used to divide nations to determine who could rule and who would be ruled, so that they could never achieve that seat of government. But for the Algonquins here, it becomes really acute because we are 38 years into, well, 30 years after the negotiations began, the largest modern treaty negotiations in Ontario's history for 36,000 square kilometers of our territory. Most of the Algonquin nation is in the province of what we know today as Quebec. But right now we have this organization that's sort of materialized in the last 15 years, calling themselves the Algonquins of Ontario. Now, the claim was initiated by my small community that back in 1983, when we sent a letter to the Governor General, as a petition, as we had since the 18th century, saying we would need you to recognize our territorial title. We've never ceded or modified title and our rights therein. But now we have individuals coming out of the woodwork, and we're so close to the finish line. Most people don't know these days, but since May, my community has actually stepped away from the negotiation table, and even the events, what has transpired at Queen's, that has, inflamed antagonisms towards what we view as, a vessel for pretendians to extinguish our title. So it's really damaging to us. It undermines our sovereignty, our rights to dispose and, govern over our territory as we'd seen fit. We're not going to rejuvenate it now. We are probably, as they predict, 2 years away from concluding the treaty. We signed an agreement in principle, or at least it was ratified by these new sort of communities that popped up in the last 15 years or so. And we'd said, in my community, we said, these aren't really Algonquins. And some of them were the ones that were, making claims to individuals who were 500 years old and saying, well, now we're going to be Algonquin just for this purpose, because they're not going to become status or become communities, but they're going to sign away our rights and title. And my community actually, after the 2016 ratification, said, the majority of us, we had a referendum internally and said, no, we don't want this deal anymore. It's a Pandora's box where as a democratic procedure for ratification, we're now the minority that's going to be overridden by the views and, impulses of pretendians who have no problem writing the other name on an eventual treaty that will give it away because they have nothing to lose. And that's
exactly,
it's a treaty. Yeah. And the crown is not likely to turn it over and give it back. Not in the next 100, 200. I think it's forever. And it hurts a lot of us. So,
and I don't think the general public thinks about the kinds of harms. We are obviously talking about harms to students, harms to Indigenous faculty, harms, but the harms extend and directly impact all of our communities, all of our First Nations, in these very profound ways. It gets tied up in theft of land, theft of rights, theft of all of these, basically hijacking these processes. Now, it's been called lots of things, fraud, theft, appropriation. One of the ways in which it's been described is settler self-indigenization. So, Veldin, if you had to kind of say in a nutshell, for just say someone is listening and they don't even know what settler self-indigenization is, how would you explain that?
Oh, there's a number of ways. And I think in Chris Anderson's opinion piece, he kind of points out that there's almost now a predictable script. there is a trajectory and a narrative that they'll adopt for themselves to create a backstory. It's really far back in history, but they bring it up to now is that they're rediscovering it. What it is, well, you know, the term that in Canada, but in the United States, Sir Sturm and Dr. Daryl LaRue has done in his magnificent work, Distorted Descent, brought the idea of race shifting is otherwise non-Indigenous, typically white. And in the case of what we see in Eastern Canada, anyways, a lot of French descendants in even your territory, Mi'kma'ki, because we've seen this sort of wave move westward and it's into Algonquin territory now, is erstwhile settlers becoming or maintaining a new sort of found identity, as they would say. And I'll use sort of the cringe that I think Dr. Talbert and Dr. Wheeler's, you know, I think underscored here is as the identity, but not necessarily, not at all in relationhood, but they become indigenized themselves in a very socially constructed or individually constructed. It's not at all social.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like how you mentioned that there's this trend or pattern because you can see it. You know, one day they come in and they're wearing some kind of sinew necklace and they're talking about this spirit helpers bringing them to their identity and trying to set up like this barrier that you can't contest. And they're like, ooh, it's almost new agey in some cases, you know? But I'd really like to kind of transition now into some of the comments, the reactions, the messages that I get on social media from people, things that I hear on a regular basis, because once you even talk about this issue, you get a lot of people responding saying, how dare you, including those who file actual complaints. But Winona, I've heard academic administrators in a multitude of universities that I have been to say, it's not our place to decide who's Indigenous. So we have no choice but to rely on self-identification. And I know you address this in your article. What's your response to an institution that says, oh, there's nothing we can do?
Well, they're kind of full of it. They have absolutely no business whatsoever defining it or who is and who is not Indigenous. Absolutely not. That's none of their business. That all falls under Indigenous jurisdiction. What universities need to do, I mean, they're all talking indigenization. They're all talking about decolonizing the academy, but that requires systemic and structural change, which most universities are just not prepared to do. And here is an excellent example of where that kind of systemic and structural change needs to happen, because the university needs to create a space in the structure, in the procedures, in the systems for Indigenous people to do this, right? For Indigenous people to take authority over that and jurisdiction over the whole quote unquote identity issue. So we'll see if that's gonna happen. I mean, there's some discussion starting to happen at the University of Saskatchewan, for example, where they wanna talk about, okay, how do we facilitate this? A lot of the faculty and staff are saying, we're the ones from here. We're the ones that have the community connections, the community networks. And so we want to be involved in this process, you know, and if somebody is applying and they're for any kind of position, even if it's an Indigenous target position, or if it's an Indigenous content position, even, and they're identifying as Indigenous, we've got a wide enough network. We can track this down. So you're telling me you're Mi'kma'ki. Okay, we got people over there. We got friends over there. We can call up old aunties. We can call up, you know, to our network to get verification. And if you can't provide that, then clearly you're not. If you can't, and my late mom used to say, if you can't provide an auntie or a cookum, then you're not. Yeah, yeah. That's all there is to it, right? Your aunties and your cookums. They're the ones that tell you who you are and where you're from. So the university, I think they're just being, yeah, they're just hiding behind that. But they need to create space. And the other thing that they're doing is, because it's such a sensitive issue, they're not looking at it in its legal context for what it is. It is fraud, identity fraud. You know, you fake it and you're accessing positions, power, authority, grants under this fraud, right? And all universities, I know we have academic misconduct regulations, And one of them in our university is impersonation. Impersonation is academic misconduct, but the university haven't even gone there yet, right? So yeah, the issue is about integrity with the universities. I mean, does our university have integrity? Are they going to stand up for what's right and call it for what it is? Or are they just going to try and skirt around it?
Yeah, it amazes me to think that that would be the response. We can't, there's nothing we can do because it's not us to do it. It's like, yeah, that's right. But you've got like Indigenous faculty and you've got communities you can partner with. How about you set up some accountability system? It just amazes me that they just can't think beyond, well, either we do it or nothing can happen because nobody else can have a say in this. And Kim, I get so many messages from people every time I do a podcast about this or talk in the media where people say that it is a form of colonization to ask someone to prove who they are by asking them, hey, where are you from? You know, who's your relatives? And they've even suggested or sent messages saying that it's not just colonized thinking, it's lateral violence and creating unsafe spaces and harassment and discrimination. All that just sounds like a red flag to me, but what's your response to people who say that it's lateral violence to even ask the question?
I mean, I don't know the history of the term lateral violence. I don't know why we can't just use the term violence if that's what the accusation is. I mean, our very charge is that they're not our laterals. So I don't know where the term lateral violence, it presupposes the answer already, the very answer that we're critiquing, which is that they're not related to us. So yeah, I mean, we have to, it is part of our custom to ask. It's like Winona was saying, right? And I also wanted to go back to something Veldin was saying. Everything that they're both saying, it just illustrates that this is not about identity politics. We're actually not talking about identity. This is really very practically a struggle for resources, land, and governmental jurisdiction. That's what's going on. And that's what is actually being challenged. And I think we need to be clear to always bring the spotlight back to that. So I might have missed part of the rest of your question, Pam, because I do have some.
Yeah, no, I was basically just saying, like, how do you respond to people who saying it's colonized thinking, it's offensive, it's harassment, it's discrimination, it's like all of these things.
I mean, I don't know. Do they have an idea? Just because we will challenge settler colonial standards for how we should be identified and how we should be categorized. But it's not that we have no standards. I mean, we have rules, right? As Winona was saying. So I don't know what people think. Like, we're like this is like Bambi and we're just out in the field all, you know, singing Kumba. Like, we have standards and rules, you know, to be part of an Indigenous community is, it's not a free for all. There are rules. I was thinking about this too. You know, I've been pounced on, I have two very specific memories. Pounced on first by somebody who years later I found out was making fraudulent claims to identity. We were at a meeting together and I said, oh, is that like a typical Cherokee custom? Because I'm not Cherokee. I'm from South Dakota, you know, and Cherokees are kind of foreign to me. And they said, how would I know? I'm like, because you're Cherokee. Like, really, they pounced on me hard. And I was taken aback. Like, I was much younger. Like, did I do something wrong? But I've also been pounced on by somebody who's legitimately, they're legitimately related to an Indigenous community. They are. I found out later they grew up away from that community. And the reaction when I asked both of them, do you know this person? Do you know that person? What tribe are you? Because we say that in the U.S., where are you from? So it's not just the people making fraudulent claims. There are people who grew up away from community that get very sensitive about this stuff. But this is the baggage of, you know, this is both, again, an asset and it's baggage. When you grow up in Indigenous community, for better and for worse, people judge you by who your family is. I've been at a meeting giving a talk and somebody was grimacing at me in the front row. And I thought they were my mom's friend. I called her after. I'm like, what's going on? This person was grimacing me. Oh, her. They got in a fight. I'm like, what's that got to do with me? But it does have a lot to do with me, right? Like, my mom is there. My grandparents are there. And it's not always an asset. Sometimes it's a burden. And when people say this is uncomfortable, especially people who want to reconnect, yeah, tell me about it. We live our whole lives with that discomfort in Indigenous community. You want to be connected? Well, you better get ready for the discomfort. This is not all happy, you know, holding hands. This is real community. Community's not always fun. Sometimes it's hard.
Exactly. And I think it's important to state here, or maybe I should have said it at the very beginning, that when we're talking about pretendians and people committing fraud and appropriation, we're not talking about people who were disconnected because of residential schools or the 60s scoop or the Indian Act or any of those like direct colonial interventions where people are now trying to reconnect legitimately. Right. We're talking about the real frauds and opportunists and fakes and all of that stuff.
But I think those making fraudulent claims are really cynically taking the narratives of the disconnected and using them to their benefit. And that's why we need to keep stating, you know, there is a place for people to connect. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to choose it. It's not easy to stay connected when you grow up in community sometimes, right? It's hard. There are divisions as well as welcoming open arms. There are both. So yeah,
no, and that's a really good point. Valden, I've got to ask you, because you know, you and I talk about these issues all the time, but I find in the last few months especially, I don't know what it is, you know, just before the Carrie Bourassa situation, I've seen, you know, my colleagues being contacted or me being contacted by a whole raft of people looking for references from a chief, an elder, a Native organization, or just any Indigenous person they know to give them a reference to say, I know so-and-so, I accept so-and-so, or I work in their Indigenous community. And I've even heard people say out loud that they want to rely on those reference letters as their proof of community acceptance, which is ergo their proof of being Indigenous. Surely that can't be what community acceptance is or our sovereignty and autonomy is all about.
Right. And I think this segues from what Kim was just talking about. This is not a free for all. When you have legitimate political institutions and citizenship being one, you know, we've had our territorial invasions occur and, you know, attempted conquests and colonialism, the, you know, dispossession of us and displacement of us as people. But rebuilding and asserting Indigenous sovereignty entails a couple of things, you know, erecting the boundaries of territorial divisions between other Indigenous nations and what agreements you might have with one another, but also how you constitute that body politic. So who is a citizen? And it's not a free for all. And we actually around the world is a very much an international norm. And it's become a little bit more pronounced too in the last two decades in the post 9/11 era is that we all travel and cross borders with a passport now. It used to be the case that you can go into the United States with a driver's license and cross, but it was still the government of or the state providing a guarantee to other state officials of, I know who this person is, and we claim them as a member of our political body. And when we say, you know what, we did have sophisticated institutions. We understood who we are, and we engaged in, you know, the civic sort of activities of, you know, understanding and renewing our nations through different peoples. And we understood who we were. Is that it isn't, you know, a house with all different sort of back doors for other people to come walking into. And it shows a profound disrespect for us is that it's just something there for, and sorry, I have to use Chris Sanderson again. When he uses the analogy with the Métis identity is like a soup kitchen for people just to come and go as they please, take what they want. But, you know, it's not lax like that. And, you know, it goes towards undermining the legitimacy of Indigenous nationhood, of us having, again, complex structures of governance, which have long been dismantled, but we're trying to hold on to the remnants or at least reconstitute, rebuild them. And, you know, every time we try to do that, we have someone coming along and saying, no, you know what, I danced at a powwow and the chief saw me, and or I'm doing work in that community. And just this sort of proximity narrative is that I want my buddy to vouch for me. Well, it doesn't work for any other nation, but they seem to have to downplay the status of us or create like a second class nationhood to such an extent that really it is a profound disrespect for us.
It's not a job application. You don't submit a letter of reference from someone who like vouches for you. Like, just because it's it just reminds me of the I'm not racist, my best friend is Indigenous. Now it's like I'm Indigenous because my best friend is Indigenous and says I'm a cool person. That's not community acceptance to me.
Can I just give an illustrative little story? Indian Country Today, the sort of national native newspaper in the United States, published an article, I think last week or the week before. And this person who is eligible for tribal citizenship in one of the US federally recognized tribes, the article was on them declining to be enrolled or to have citizenship, and because they didn't want to be on a list of Indians. And what that does is it speaks to the profound disregard and disempowerment of tribal nation governance, because I bet you that person doesn't function without a state ID. And if they leave the country, they don't do that without a U.S. passport. So I'm sure they're willing, because they have to be on a list of state citizens and U.S. citizens, but a list of tribal citizens is somehow colonial. I mean, we live inside a colonial edifice, but all it did was speak to how disempowered tribes are. Mm-hmm. That's all it did. It was portrayed as some kind of moral choice. I was kind of disappointed in that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's just so many things about this. It's so upsetting. So like, I have a list of things that I've heard people saying in social media, comebacks, basically, to kinds of the things that we're saying. And I'd love to get your reaction, and feel free, you know, just to jump in if you have something to add. But Winona, I've heard someone say that they're Indigenous because they are, quote, community involved. They do research with a community, they've worked and volunteered with the community, and that's a form of community acceptance, ergo they are Indigenous.
No, at the very least, it's just allyship. It's craziness, right? It's like, you know, me going to Australia and working with Pitmunjara people and a family taking me in and calling me daughter and calling me sister. And I walk away from that community and suddenly I'm Pitmunjara and I start speaking on their behalf. I mean, that's craziness, right? They accept me while I'm there as a member of their family, as long as I'm contributing, right? If I wander away and I don't come back, you know, I don't think that relationship will be extended that long. But you hear that a lot. You know, the community accepts me. I do good work in the community. And there are people doing good work in the community. There's no denying that. But it doesn't mean you are us.
Yeah. And what's wrong with being a friend, a relative, an ally, a supporter? You know, what's wrong with being that and owning that? Instead of also now we have to go from supporter to appropriator of these things. I'm not even sure how some.
I mean, exactly. You can't claim resources if, you know, necessarily, right? I mean, you don't have to. It's like Winona says, you can be a relative without being us. I mean, I have relatives in different tribal nations, right? I have relatives in different countries who speak different languages. I have relatives across different racial categories that I don't belong to. Both biological and made. Yeah, this is not that hard.
No.
Unless you're trying to make a resource grab. Yeah.
Okay, well, here's a skill testing one for you, Kim. Spirit helpers guided me to my identity, and no Native person has the right to dispute my ancestors.
I wouldn't even know what that means. So the spirits are their ancestors and their spirits are the same? Oh, and yes. So the spirits of their ancestors came back and called them back into this?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's also a mark of, again, when I listen to people who grew up in Indigenous community, you know, sure, we talk about our ancestors. They're important, right? And we all have important kind of ancestors who were figureheads in our cultures who did important historical things to keep the people together, especially, or some kind of were traitors to the people, but whatever. but really what kind of coheres us are living people. I think I am very, it's a red flag to me when all somebody can do is point to ancestors in the past. I mean, if they can't point to an ongoing living community, and I wrote a piece on my Substack, we are not your dead ancestors. We are living communities. And if all you can do is point to a bunch of dead Indians and bones, and I don't mean to be disrespectful of our ancestors and their bones, because they have been, you know, desecrated. But that's not what we're talking about. I mean, those ancestors are related to and help make the way for the living Indigenous communities that exist today. It requires connection to living peoples who have cultural and governance authorities. This isn't just about finding some bones and making some kind of claim to that.
No, so important.
Velvin, I want to carry that further, if you don't mind. I mean, if somebody pulls the spirituality thing on you, it's a way to shut you down. You know, it's a violent way to shut you down, because who wants to challenge somebody's spirituality? But the reality is, in my, among my people anyway, your spirituality is very, very personal. That's your gig, and you got no right to impose that on anybody else. But by them imposing it on everybody else, they're using it as a weapon.
Yes, that's so dishonorable to actually use something so important like that as a weapon. Velden, how about this? Is this a red flag? It's always been my life dream to be part of an Indigenous community, and I've done the hard work to be part of an Indigenous community. Therefore, I am Indigenous.
So, you know, we're on a couple of examples now, and they almost all sound absurd, but I can guarantee to anyone watching this today that we've all heard these a dozen times, probably in the last month alone. I was just sort of giggling at the spirit helper mentioned earlier. You hear some sort of version of this, and then doing the hard work is somehow this some sort of spirit helper. I don't even know what that is. That, you know, that is the new agey nonsense too. Somehow you're an apprentice or something to become Indigenous. There's also in those kind of ideas, the fetishism for us. I've always wanted to be Indigenous. You know, that's some sort of racial arrogance to be able to discard your own, you know, history and situatedness to just say, I'm going to move over there. I'm going to take up that identity because we certainly can't. I'm fairly white passing, but and I can move through life in a lot of white spaces. There are features of me that I just can't shape and leave behind. And also what Kim says, the community of, you know, I don't know what kind of hard work it is to go onto online genealogy forums to connect to, you know, bones and dust, is that they are, and to be respectful too, as Kim points out, is that, and I've mentioned this to you a couple of times in the last year. So the narrative suggests to me is the community they're looking for is in the graveyard, but we are a living community. It's not a dead community. We're not, you know, zombies. And I can't remember. I read something from an Australian scholar recently is something along the lines of what Kim said. We are not your dead ancestors. But to do this hard work, you know, I don't know what's harder. Like, I don't know how easier it can be to be born. Our life is can be often very difficult under colonial circumstances. But is try as you might, like, is this some sort of performance and production that they want to put on? You know, because they end up looking like, they are the charlatans who are the, you know, community involved that you talked about earlier, is somehow they glean some sort of knowledge from proximity. Again, I come from a mixed family where I don't have any ancestry for Inuk being an Inuit at all, but I do have two family members. Can't claim it, sorry. And I would hope that they would laugh forever thinking that my community involvement with them entitled me to any sort of set of political rights and responsibilities and claims. But what hard work. It's a hobby for some of these people. It's a fetish.
It really is. And so I've got three more, and some of these just make me ill, but this one's for Kim because she's written so much about this, you know, native DNA and ancestry and all of that. What about the person who says, I have native blood that runs through my veins. There is blood memory in that blood. And so no one can deny my native ancestry, even if it's 400 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I often say ancestry alone is not a claim. Right. I mean, we all, you know, I have ancestry among multiple other Indigenous peoples that I do not identify with. I wasn't raised among them. I have ancestry among European peoples that they did not raise me. I've never been to those places. I don't know those cultures at all. So it would be disingenuous, I think, to claim that. This runs in again to this sort of conflation or I think even sometimes there's alleged ancestry and it's not actual, but sometimes there is actual ancestry a long time ago, right? But again, ancestry alone is not a claim, whether it's there or not. Now, I think I understand sometimes people's confusion because, and I'll speak for the US because I know tribal citizenship rules down there. We, you know, I don't know a tribe anymore. There might be a couple that do citizenship based on marriage into the tribe or adopted, legally adopted children. before World War II, that was actually quite common. When most Natives were on the reservation, 90% of Natives were on the reservation, it was easy to know who everybody was related to, whether by blood or whether by marriage or whatever, or adoption, you know. But with urbanization and World War II, and you have 75% of Natives moving off the reservation and into urban areas, tribes suddenly get much more careful about documenting biological ancestry. But again, this isn't simply internalized colonization. What they are doing is responding to the overwhelming political and economic power of the settler state. We are always responding to the political economy of the settler state and a global economy. We do not have the power to match theirs. So when people say, well, we're just supposed to do these traditional citizenship forms, first of all, traditions are dynamic. That's true, but it's not just that. It's very difficult to juxtapose tradition and what we want to do in a world in which we are at a severe power imbalance, right? And so, yes, we do use forms of ancestry, but I think what's important in that is that we're trying to figure out which forms of ancestry to use. How can we both manage our communities? I mean, we struggle on this line between being inclusive of our own relations and not making it just an open kind of free-for-all, right? It's a very difficult position to be in. So I do have a lot of sympathy for the struggles that community, Indigenous communities have in trying to balance this. And I am never okay with people saying we're simply internalizing colonialism. That tells me they haven't lived in those communities and seen the everyday struggle of how we have to deal with these things legally, right? Culturally, politically, and economically. It's a constant struggle.
It is. And the way in which they misinterpret, misuse, and misadapt, stereotype, and generalize what's a Native custom or what's a tradition. Winona, this one's for you. What do you say to the person who, well, I have a friend in this community and as an adult, he adopted me into the community because that's Native custom, that adoptions are allowed. So I am therefore a Native person.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit already earlier. No.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an episode from November 27, 2021, created by the Warrior Life podcast, hosted by Pam Palmater. If you want to hear the rest of the show, you can head to Pam Palmater on YouTube. And before you go, here's some news that you can use. McGill's annual Africa Speaks Conference starts today at 6 p.m. It's a three-part series organized by the McGill African Student Society. This year's event is online and focuses on Africa in the media. The African Student Society is also teaming up with the Spanish and Latin American Students Association to offer a free online cooking demonstration night. There will be vegetarian and non-alcoholic options available. That's next Thursday, February 24th at 6 p.m. You can find more information about the Africa Speaks Conference or the cooking demonstration on the McGill African Student Society Facebook page. And McGill students have organized a free throat singing event called the Throat Singing and Sisterhood. There will be a demonstration and a discussion of the history and mechanics behind this practice. That's Wednesday, February 23rd at 6 p.m. Look up the event organizer, the McGill Anthropology Students Association, on Facebook for more information. And McGill's East Asian Studies Student Association is organizing its first career discussion panel. There will be speakers from a variety of sectors like business, diplomacy, and academia. That's tomorrow, Saturday, February 19th at 8 p.m. More details are on the McGill's East Asian Studies Student Association's Facebook page. And the Yiddish cultural organization, Klez Kanata, is organizing a free short film showcase all about its annual summer retreat in the Laurentian Mountains. Klez Kanata will start streaming the event on Facebook Live at 2 p.m. on Sunday, February the 20th. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, Tess Pilkington, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate, or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHourMTL, or connect with us on Facebook. Just search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on 90.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
L'épidémie mondiale de la COVID-19 a affecté les vies de chacun de différentes manières. Elle a également attiré notre attention sur l'intensification du racisme systémique et de la xénophobie sélective envers nos amis racisés dans notre société canadienne. Il est compréhensible que chacun d'entre nous se sente anxieux face à cette maladie dangereuse. Cependant, ce sentiment d'angoisse ne nous donne pas le droit de commettre des crimes de haine et de discriminer nos amis asiatiques, noirs, autochtones et autres personnes racisées. Il n'est pas acceptable d'associer la maladie COVID-19 aux Asiatiques, en particulier